Coming up on Tech News Weekly, I, Micah Sargent, am here. Jason Howell's out, but don't worry, he'll be back. And this week, I've got a great show planned for you. First, we talk to 9to5 Max and Space Explored's Zach Hall about how NASA is sending an iPad around the moon to help test Alexa. Yes, Amazon's voice assistant. Kind of interesting, huh? Then we talk to Izzy Lepowski of Protocol about Pinterest and the civil rights investigation it's currently facing in California. After that, Protocol is back, but this time with Max Cherney to talk about how Google has made a custom chip specifically for encoding, transcoding, and presenting YouTube video. Very interesting stuff whenever you get real focused in on those chips. Before I round things out with a couple of stories of the week, including the Plex data breach and all about dogs and how they cry tears and make you produce more oxytocin. Stay tuned. I've got a great show ahead for you.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 249, recorded Thursday, August 25th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. It's hosted by Bridget Todd. This season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player. And by ClickUp, the productivity platform that'll save you one day a week on work guaranteed. Use code TNW to get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Sign up today at ClickUp.com. Hurry, because this offer ends soon. And by ZipRecruiter. Certain people make my life easier by helping me out. And ZipRecruiter makes hiring easier because they do the work for you. How? Well, ZipRecruiter's technology finds great candidates and you can invite them to apply. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNW to try it for free. Hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. And by we, I mean me. And ye, all of you out there listening, because Jason Howell is not here with us this week. We'll be back. But for this week, I am driving this train solo. Anyway, I'm Micah Sargent, one of the hosts of Tech News Weekly, and I am excited to be going to space today with 9to5 Max Zach Hall, / Space Explored's Zach Hall. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Micah. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, so good to get you on the show to talk about space stuff, because if there's one thing I know, it's that you know a thing or two about space and everything we have to do with it, right?
I know a lot about Apple, and I will talk to anybody about space endlessly. anyone who will listen.
Well, today you have a captive audience as they are tuning in, so we can talk about space. You wrote a story over on 9to5 Mac that kind of had the perfect mixture of everything coming together. You got to talk about space, but you also got to talk about the iPad. Before we get to that, though, let's kick things off with what's about to happen. NASA is about to launch a rocket. What is this rocket? What is the project? And where is this rocket headed?
So people probably know about the Apollo program, the moon mission back from the late 60s, early 70s, where we sent astronauts to the moon. And we haven't done that since 1974. So we're doing it again in this decade, which a couple of years ago is news to me. And since then, I've just been obsessed with following every little detail. And the big part of that is this program called Artemis, which is the twin sister goddess of the moon. So there's that connection there. And it's all about going back to the moon, but making it sustainable this time, so that you've got not just, you know, go and experiment and see what you can do there, but try to build an economy there, try to have private industry involved as well, and then use the moon as kind of a stepping stone toward, you know, Mars and beyond, deep space. So that's all very exciting. What's happening Monday is Space Launch System, or SLS, is the rocket that will take us to the moon. And it's the very first launch of this SLS rocket. It's been in the making for a long time. The spacecraft is called Orion. That's what the rocket sends to the moon. And on Artemis 1, the first mission, it will go up for about 40 days and orbit the moon and do a lot of science without any astronauts on board. This is just to test the rocket because it's the first time they've ever launched it and use this hardware and the spacecraft to make sure it can actually withstand going around the moon for a month and then coming back and withstand the heat, you know, of Earth's atmosphere on reentry. Yeah. And then the really cool part is in a couple of years, in the next 2, 3, 4 years, we're going to send a crew of astronauts around the moon, which will be the first time we've returned to the moon since the 70s. And then the second or the third mission, Artemis 3, is going to be actual boots on the moon. And the really cool thing about it is it's the first time we're sending, it's going to be the first woman and first person of color to walk on the moon. So that's locked in stone. So it's not only historic for returning to the moon in our lifetime, but doing it in a way that makes history as well. So super exciting stuff.
You've revealed that I am going to be the first person on the moon. We were supposed to keep that a secret. No, alas, it is not me, but I am very excited about that. That's amazing. I mean, yeah, we're going to get to watch this happen in our lifetime instead of it kind of having to be stuff that we take in via media online. And so with the project. Now I understand that it's kind of a sort of trial to make sure everything's good to go. I imagine this is pretty typical, right? They tend to try out the rockets a few times before they put human bodies into them.
Sure. If you look at the Apollo history, there was a tragic explosion that took the three lives of the three astronauts that were going to take one of the early Saturn V rockets. And since then, they corrected and they did a lot of testing before they ended up flying astronauts again. And in this case, they're not going to just start out with new hardware that they've never used before. So they're doing this uncrewed test, which is very cool. They're going to have a mannequin on board called Moonikin Campos, which has its own story. They're also going to do this cool thing where there's a tech angle to it, which I found kind of late in all of this, which is there. You know, you mentioned the iPad. There's this partnership with NASA, Amazon, Cisco, and Lockheed Martin called Callisto. And what they're doing is they're testing Amazon Alexa in space. So it's, you know, the first time they've ever done that. First time there's been an iPad go to the moon because there weren't many iPads around in the 70s. And, that's very exciting. The deal with that is they want to see – it's a very minor part of this mission because it really is about testing the rocket and testing the spacecraft. But, you know, throw on what you can. And the high level of it is they want to test out consumer technology on a spacecraft, because before you'd use, you know, the state of the art stuff, but consumer technology wasn't quite space ready. And in this case, you know, compared to the 70s, we have a lot of stuff that could be useful. So the big idea there is how could you use voice control on a spacecraft? You know, you could check flight status, like telemetry data. You could see the spacecraft's orientation by voice. You could ask about water supply levels and battery voltage. So a lot of stuff that could be useful in the future.
Especially with the reduced dexterity that one has while they're in space, that definitely makes sense, that being able to just speak out loud and have that work is quite nice. Now, one of the things that I think is kind of interesting here is, or that I'm curious about, of course, these are consumer-facing products. These are products made by companies. The iPad comes from Apple, the Amazon Alexa device that is not quite the Echo, but has Alexa built into it, is from Amazon. I think about the reading about the James Webb telescope and hearing about all of the different scientists who basically got on a list to be able to to say, we want to be part of this. And I remember even back in school learning about all of the different folks around the world who, anytime it's like, oh, they're going to space, we're trying to test this thing. So researchers sort of reach out and say, can we please put our petri dish into the payload that goes into space so we can test that? So I'm not surprised to hear, you know, I'm sure along with the not Bodie McBoatface, but the Mooney.
Moonikin Campos, yeah.
Yeah, Moonikin Campos going there. I'm not so surprised to hear about this, but is this a in partnership with Amazon? And then the second kind of aside from that is, I think some listeners would benefit from having a clarification given the private companies, or the, I guess some of them are publicly traded companies, but the companies that are not sort of funded by taxes, they are also going to, yeah, commercial companies going to space. Mm-hmm. NASA is doing its own thing here, or is it using technology that Blue Origin and the other ones have come up with?
So first question, Amazon. Let's see. Remind me the first question.
The first question was, is, I guess it kind of is all one question now that I think about it. Is Amazon helping out more than just providing the ALEXA voice technology? Is this NASA kind of working with Amazon, or is it just that, you know, NASA said, and by working with, I mean, there's a monetary exchange, like, oh,
yeah.
Amazon says, we'd love it if we were the first ones to go to space. So make sure you tell everybody about that while we're there helping make this happen. Or was it more so that NASA, if you know this, said, we want to try this voice technology. There's already consumer tech, so let's give it a go.
Yeah, what I would say is that Amazon and Cisco, they're both commercial companies that we all know, and we use WebEx and everything Amazon. Those are the two commercial companies that the way I see it is that they just, you know, probably sponsor in some way this, and there's probably a lot of urge to get something, you know, more than just this test mission out of the way, you know, more something that reaches the public in a bigger way. And you can even ask your Echo, you know, questions about the moon right now, and it will relate back to you things about this mission. So you can ask about the Artemis program. So there's a big connection there. And then Lockheed Martin is the other commercial company, and they've got involvement with Orion. So that's the spacecraft. So that's the big thing. What I did learn in this, though, was that NASA was only using the language of tablet. They wouldn't say iPad.
And yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. And, you know, being me, I had to ask, you know, hey, do you know what kind of tablet it will be? Because, you know, you could say maybe it's some sort of an Amazon tablet, but no, they said it's definitely an iPad. And what made me, you know, that just led me to believe that, you know, Apple wasn't commercially involved in this, but they're taking, you know, the best off the shelf tablet, you know, for what this can do. And they're going to, you know, use it that way. And then your second question, remind me there again.
Kind of NASA independent project, or do the other companies factor into it?
Sure. So right now for Artemis 1 and 2, it's NASA and their partners, you know, kind of legacy partners. But with Artemis 3, the one that involves astronauts going down to the moon, what Orion will do is get to lunar orbit around the moon. But they still need a human landing system. HLS is what they call that. And they're using SpaceX as Starship. So that's a commercial company that we all know about. And that's like NASA is a big customer of SpaceX's now for that reason. And so before, Starship was just this thing that was SpaceX's, you know, for their own business. And NASA's, you know, big investment there says, we want to see this be as successful as possible, as soon as possible, because they want to go before the end of the decade.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. See, that's interesting whenever you've got them both coming together. And the last thing that I'll ask you, and you may have touched on this at the top when you talked about this project, but I want to kind of hammer home this point, because I saw some folks in the chat asking about this, and I think that other people will be curious too. And I know that it's going to be a question that you are happy to answer. Why are we sending people to the moon?
Good question. People want to explore. People want to go. And it's not just a U.S. thing this time. It's very international. There's this thing called the Artemis Accords, which is several countries, not just the U.S., but, you know, maybe like a dozen countries that are all working together for this. So that's the idea, is you've got commercial companies that are going to do it anyway, but to get, you know, right now commercial companies have reached low Earth orbit, you know, to the space station. They're traveling back and forth, and they're going to build their own space stations in low Earth orbit. But to go to the moon, you need government agencies to back the kind of thing, because it isn't great business per se. That's when you need, you know, countries, nations to be behind this kind of thing. And then boosts commercial companies, and they hope, you know, the whole program there, the idea there is that once NASA, the U.S. and other countries are involved, then they build the infrastructure, kind of like building the interstate and the highways and trains and that kind of thing first, and then having commercial companies do the rest. And they've built the infrastructure, and then commercial companies can take it even further.
Nice. Well, Zach Hall, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I know it'll be hard for folks to reach you over the coming days as you'll be sneaking onto that rocket that's going into space.
I'll be close.
I heard you're gonna get to watch it. That's very
about 2 miles away. Yeah, it's a good place to be.
Wow. So if folks want to follow you online and maybe see your videos or photos or follow along as that's happening, where should they go to do so?
You can follow me on Twitter at Apollo Zach. That's APOLLOZAC. And all of our space stories will be at spaceexplored.com.
Awesome. Thank you, Zach. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Micah.
Enjoy the launch. All right, folks, up next, we're going to be talking to Issy Lepowski about Pinterest and a civil rights investigation in California. Before we get there, though, I do want to take a quick break to tell you about IRL. It is an original podcast from Mozilla. Super exciting. Love Mozilla's Firefox browser. We've had folks on the show before from Mozilla to talk about all the great work that they're doing. And yes, this podcast is there for you too. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. It's hosted by Bridget Todd, and this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Who can AI help? Who can it harm? The show features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. So here are some examples. There's an episode about how our world is mapped with AI. The data that's missing from those maps tells as much of a story as the maps themselves. So you'll get to hear about the people who are working to fill in those gaps and take control of the data. There's also an episode about gig workers who depend on apps for their livelihood. It looks at how they're pushing back against algorithms that control how much they get paid and seeking new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. And then for political junkies, there are episodes about the role that AI plays when it comes to the spread of misinformation and hate speech around elections, which of course is a huge concern for democracies around the world. This is a perfect time to talk about the episode that's right there about how gig workers are kind of trying to circumvent it. It's called When an Algorithm is Your Boss. And, you know, I had seen many times getting into an Uber or Lyft or using one of the grocery delivery services, how these sort of employees, although they aren't considered employees in many cases, are working around the system in every possible way they can, having multiple phones for Uber or with Instacart, having a separate system that automatically sends messages and keeps the person updated. There's all of this stuff that I've just found so fascinating as they try to kind of work around the positions that are built in based on the AI, and how because it's an AI that's at the heart of the behavior of passing out the roles, they don't have a way to kind of move directly against and say, hey, we don't want this because it's the AI that's doing it. So if you are into that idea of sort of humans being resourceful, I found that episode in particular to be a really empowering episode, despite the fact that it was also a bit disheartening in terms of kind of understanding what work these employees have to do to get through to do the job that they want to do. So if you would like to check out all things AI, search for IRL in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. And of course, our thanks to IRL for their support of this show and all of the Twit Network. All right, we are back from the break, and that means it's time for the second story today. Joining us to talk about the investigation that Pinterest is currently facing is Protocol's Issy Lepowski. Welcome back to the show, Issy.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's always great to get you on. Before we kind of dig into the specifics of this investigation, I was hoping you could start by kind of laying a foundation here. Could you tell us what California's Civil Rights Department typically investigates? I'm kind of curious, kind of what is the role of the CCRD? And I learned a new thing when I learned that they used to be called something else here in California.
Yeah, I mean, it's all right there in the name. They used to be called the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Now they're the California Civil Rights Division. Basically, it's, you know, investigating discrimination, harassment, retaliation in employment and housing. Their purview is pretty wide. You know, it could be anything from a case investigating an apartment complex that's discriminating on the basis of race to, because so many of our tech companies are based in California, you know, investigations around employee discrimination.
Okay, so thank you for helping us to kind of understand if, especially folks who listen from outside of California, who, you know, you hear California Civil Rights Department and may be curious specifically what they're focusing on. Do we know why the CCRD is investigating Pinterest specifically? In your piece, you mentioned that you quote Pinterest, who says that the company, or rather, you quote that the company is only one of the companies that is being investigated by the CCRD. And it was unclear to me if they were kind of saying, hey, you know, the CCRD is constantly investigating all these companies, or if they were saying that Pinterest was part of a current group of companies that they were investigating as part of a larger issue. So if you could clarify that for us, that'd be awesome.
Sure. So the first question you asked, do we know exactly what they're being investigated for? No, I don't know exactly. The department's not saying, Pinterest is not saying, and the witnesses who have been contacted so far have not gotten too much information. They just started getting emails from the department on Tuesday night. And what I can say about that is, you know, from my sources, it sounds like most of the people, if not all of the people who have been contacted are women, women of various races. So it's possible that this has something to do with gender discrimination. And, you know, it isn't hard to connect the dots there. Pinterest has settled a case with its former chief operating officer in 2020 over gender discrimination. They did not admit to any liability in that case, but it could be that this is something that the department is investigating more broadly. And they've also faced other allegations of gender discrimination, pay discrimination from two former employees, Ifeoma Ozoma and Erica Shimizu Banks. So there is a little bit of a history there. And as for Pinterest's statement saying they're not the only company being investigated, you know, you can read into that as much as I can. Of course, that's true. The department is investigating lots of other companies in lots of other contexts. I don't know that they were insinuating that this was part of some sort of like mass investigation into a lot of tech companies being studied as a group. But for instance, we know that the department has a lawsuit ongoing against Tesla. There have been, you know, settlements against other tech companies in the past. And so, yes, their statement is factual. If they're trying to imply something a little bit more, I don't quite know.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of, I think, is part of a statement like that. If you can word it just right, then it helps to be able to say, for me to read into it one way or another way and go, okay, is this just sort of laying out a blatant truth that, of course, they are one of a number of companies that are being investigated always? Or are they trying to say, you know, don't look over here because, you know, they're looking at a lot of companies. They're always looking at companies. That's I guess, a very clever PR quote.
It's classic deflection for sure.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about the history of the alleged discrimination at Pinterest. And I phrase it that way in this case because there are ongoing cases and some settlements that have actually happened in the past. But there's certainly a history of again, alleged discrimination there. And you did briefly touch on that.
Sure. So I would say this really started coming out in June of 2020, right around the time that a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests were happening. And similarly, around the time that a lot of corporations, including Pinterest, were coming out and saying how important, you know, racial justice was to them. Well, two of its former employees, as I mentioned, Ifoma and Erica, they saw these statements and felt like they were sort of empty because based on their experience at the company, that had not been their experience. Both women have said that they raised concerns about their supervisor inside of Pinterest to HR and that those concerns were, you know, dismissed and that they were often retaliated against for raising those concerns. And, you know, if anything, it leveled more suspicion on them as employees than it did on their superior. They also alleged, you know, pay and leveling discrimination. Leveling, of course, in tech is this, you know, really important thing to determine how much money you're making. And so people want to be sure that they're leveled at the, you know, at the right place for their experience and for their output. And so they've alleged discrimination with regard to leveling. And one of the women, you know, talked about how she had, you know, been on the receiving end of some, you know, racially insensitive remarks from her superior. So this all came out in 2020 in a series of tweets from both of these women. Those tweets quickly went viral, and it was, you know, a big part of the news because, you know, Pinterest is a company that is in many ways, you know, built on the backs of female users. I mean, they're always talking about how they're for female empowerment. And so the fact that, you know, these stories were coming out that showed that behind the scenes, they weren't necessarily living up to that at a very, you know, tense moment in the country with regard to race, you know, that it made a lot of headlines. Cut to a couple months later, Pinterest former chief operating officer wrote her own, you know, viral post about the discrimination she felt she had experienced. She described Pinterest as really being this boys club run by Ben Silberman and a few of his deputies, all men, and that she, even as the COO, was being left out of conversations, that she raised concerns about this internally and was fired and retaliated for it. That was her allegation. By December of 2020, there was a massive settlement with that woman, $22.5 million to settle that case, which I believe is one of the biggest gender discrimination settlements there is. So that's a little bit of the history dating back to 2020. And since then, of course, Pinterest has said that they have, you know, made a lot of changes. They have made certain commitments. They've hired new talent to deal with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And of course, their CEO and co-founder, Ben Silberman, has since left the role of CEO.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, because there was something overall positive that came from these ongoing situations, the Silenced No More Act. Can you tell us about that act and how it relates to this Pinterest investigation?
Sure. So Ifeoma Ozoma, who was one of the women who wrote those viral tweets in the summer of 2020 and talked about her experience of race discrimination, she has co-sponsored this law in California called the Silence No More Act. And the goal of that law is to really expand upon a law that had been passed right after, you know, the Me Too era that said that California employers cannot impose non-disclosure agreements that would prevent people from speaking out about gender discrimination. And so the reason that Ifeoma was able to speak out and the reason Erica was able to speak out is because of that law that protected them as women. But these are also Black women, and Erica is Black and Asian. And they said, you know, we experienced discrimination that was gendered, but it was also racist. And they wanted to ensure that anybody who experiences any sort of discrimination is able to speak about it despite their NDAs. So that's exactly what the Silence No More Act does. It expands upon that Me Too era law and says that anybody who has experienced discrimination, harassment, retaliation of any sort that is illegal in the state of California can speak out about it despite their NDAs. And it actually includes very specific language that California employers have to put into their employee agreements in order to be compliant. And this law has since really snowballed. And now there's a similar law similar law in Washington state that is actually even broader and deals with, you know, a wage discrimination and things like that. So this is something that's sort of spreading in laws in states across the country, and also something that companies are, due to the pressure being applied to them by IFOMA and a coalition she's in, adopting into their own employee agreements, even in states where there haven't been laws passed. So you've seen Apple, you've seen Google, you've seen Salesforce, a number of companies, and Pinterest included, coming out and amending their own employee agreements to include this language, even in states where the law doesn't exist.
Well, I thank you for explaining a little bit more about that. I'm curious in the end how these California Civil Rights Department investigations tend to play out in terms of kind of what steps take place and what action results at the end of these investigations. Do we have some examples of tech companies that have been investigated and the investigation has been completed rather than the ongoing ones that we've seen, and what typically results from these investigations?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can think of this like any law enforcement investigation. There's going to be an investigation. There's going to be an opportunity probably for mediation, if that's an appropriate remedy. There's an opportunity for settlement. So we've seen, you know, Riot Games settled a $100 million settlement in a sex discrimination case with this department. There's also the possibility, if you know it doesn't go to settlement, if it doesn't go to mediation, it would go to a lawsuit. And that's what we're seeing right now with Tesla. Is facing a race discrimination lawsuit in December. It was reported that Google was also being investigated for alleged discrimination against Black women. So we've seen this go any number of ways, from, you know, probably mediated silently to really big settlements to ongoing lawsuits to, you know, some that are still just in that investigation phase, which it appears is what's going on with Pinterest right now.
Absolutely. Well, Izzy Lipowski, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day today to talk to us about this investigation with Pinterest. Of course, folks can head over to protocol.com to check out the great work that you're doing there. Is there anywhere else they can go to be sure to keep up with what you're doing?
Sure. Yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at Izzy Lipowski.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, we've got another Protocol guest who joined me yesterday to talk about YouTube and its own custom chips. We'll get to that in just a moment, but I do want to tell you about ClickUp, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. Let's think about this. Imagine having one extra day every week. More time to cook meals, work on a novel, binge some really good reality TV, whatever it is that you want to do with that extra day. Wouldn't it be great to have an extra day? When I thought about what I would do with an extra day, I think I'd spend many of my extra days just getting in a lot more sleep. But when I wasn't doing that, I would have so much more time for the different craft projects that I like to work on. It'd be so nice. Well, ClickUp can help make that possible. It's the productivity platform that'll save you one day a week on work. Folks, guaranteed. ClickUp began with the premise that productivity was broken. If you start there, and you know, there were too many tools to keep track of, too many things and entirely separate ecosystems, there had to be a more productive way to get through the daily hustle. So ClickUp is the one tool that can house all of your tasks, all of your projects, all of your docs, all of your goals, all of your spreadsheets, and it doesn't stop there. ClickUp is built for teams from one, so if you want to use it for yourself, you can, to 1,000 or more. It's packed with features and customization options that no other productivity tool has, so you can work the way you work best. Whether you're in project management, engineering, sales, marketing, or HR, ClickUp has easy-to-use solutions that create a more efficient work environment. Join more than 800,000 highly productive teams that are using ClickUp today. Use code TNW, and in doing so, you will get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Under $5 a month, can you believe? Sign up today at clickup.com and use the code TNW. But please hurry, because this offer ends soon. Thank you, ClickUp, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. And now we're going to do a bit of time traveling. All right, so think about this. We've got YouTube. YouTube, of course, deals with thousands upon thousands of videos all the time. And you may think, man, I wonder what's happening behind the scenes with all of those videos that they're constantly processing. Well, joining us today to talk about that process and the work that Google has done to make YouTube's processing even better is Max Cherney of Protocol. Welcome back to the show, Max.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, I sent it in the email invite to you, but you have quickly become one of our listeners' favorite guests because you've always got some really nerdy and interesting things to talk about. So thank you.
Well, I do my best to raise the level of nerdy wherever I go.
Well, before we get into the nerdy, I think it would be a good idea for the listeners out there to lay a foundation. And that foundation, when it comes to chips, really seems to center around Moore's Law. In fact, that's kind of how you start the piece. I'm curious, could you give our listeners kind of a basic understanding of what Moore's Law is?
Absolutely. I'm happy to. So it dates back to 1965, actually, so a really long time ago, when Intel co-founder Gordon Moore, made an observation. And that was basically that, roughly speaking, the number of transistors on a chip would double every 2 years, and the cost of those chips would decrease. So this essentially set the foundational guidance, for lack of a better way to put it, for the entire chip industry for decades to come. These assumptions have underpinned everything from R&D spending to product roadmaps and the way we think about them. In the industry itself, there is some debate about whether it's still true or not, whether Moore's Law is alive or dead. I think it's sort of one of those it's complicated ideas, because on the face of it, it's objectively true that the number of transistors on each chip is not doubling anymore at this point. That has certainly slowed, and you know, you can count them, so there's no arguments there really. But what we've developed other ways to continue to get a similar performance gains. So that's sort of where the debate revolves around. Companies like Intel, for obvious reasons, I think, say it's still alive. And companies like NVIDIA and Jensen, the CEO, have been saying that it's dead for several years now. So that's sort of the really basic part. A lot of the way we think about chips comes from that 65 paper, weirdly enough.
Wow. Yeah. It's kind of wild to think that this theory from so long ago ends up being the underpinning for a lot of including like buying that happens today. So I think one of the things that folks maybe who even know a lot about or have a basic understanding of Moore's Law might not be aware that Google designs its own chips, and you know, maybe, or now we know more than the ones that we had heard about for sure. Can you tell us a bit about its tensor processing units, those TPUs?
Absolutely. So this was an idea, you know, again, it sort of dates back to this thinking that perhaps Moore's Law is no longer as true as it once was. And as Google was sort of looking at the different kinds of computing it was doing, it realized that it essentially wasn't getting the performance gains it had expected, you know, every 2 years. So they... And Google is a company that spends a lot of time and money on their artificial intelligence, efforts, whether that ends up being in the consumer's hands, on your phone, or whether that's sort of bigger stuff or scientific research or whatever. Google's very interested in AI for, again, I think lots of obvious reasons. So Google is looking at that problem. The AI requires an enormous amount of computing power, an unlimited amount. In fact, most people tell me that if you throw compute at an AI problem, if you throw 1,000 times more compute at the same problem, they will happily use 1,000 times more, 100,000 times more, or whatever. So it uses a lot of compute power. So Google decided to make its own chip that tackles this exact thing called the TPU, the tensor processing unit. And technically I don't want to get too much into the weeds on its specific design and capabilities, but it really did give Google a sort of leg up against its competitors who didn't have anything like it. And it's pretty foundational to, you know, even things like your spam in your Gmail. That's what the TPUs are used for, or detecting spam phone calls, or making photos look nicer. There's lots of like really obvious stuff that, you know, it's in your hands essentially that these TPUs are designed for. And it saves Google a ton of money because it doesn't have to build so many data centers.
So in your piece, you say that Google discovered video sharing service YouTube, which of course Google owns, was, quote, the largest consumer of video-related computing at Google. I think that, you know, a lot of people go, oh, that definitely makes sense. This consumer-facing video sharing service probably is going to take up a lot of what Google does. But some folks, and I think this is the important part here, they might not be aware of the way that YouTube processes the video that's uploaded to its service. So before we get into these new chips that we brought you on the show to talk about, can you explain why we even needed to, or they needed to look at this in the first place? It's not the case that when I upload a video from my iPhone, then it's just kind of like a storage there on YouTube and just gets played back directly?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the rub really just revolves around the fact that they have to display the video on dozens or thousands of different kinds of screens and lots of different formats. So think about it. I mean, you got a TV, a laptop computer, a smartphone, all of which will access videos on YouTube very differently. Your television might use one format. Your computer on the web might use another format. The YouTube app on your iPhone might use a different format. The Android version might have another format on it. So you see what I'm saying? Is that there's just lots of different kinds of formats. So when somebody uploads a video to YouTube, what YouTube does is they take that file and they essentially make copies of it. They convert it to all these different kinds of sizes and resolutions and formats so that they don't have to do that whenever you press the play button, because then you would sit there looking at that little wheel that goes around and around forever, because it takes a long time to transcode these things. The process is called transcoding, and sometimes or YouTube told me that there are as many as 15 files for each video that you would see on YouTube. So they do a lot of processing on the back end to make it a very seamless consumer, you know, experience to watch something.
Wow, that quite a few. And then Google kind of, well, a leader at Google said, you know what, this is a problem that we can tackle. And sort of, I encourage everyone to head to Protocol and read the piece, kind of hearing the story of how this happened, the introduction of the Argos chip. Can you tell us about the improvements that Google saw in actually deploying these chips? I think they're in their second or third generation now.
Yeah, second gen, and they've got two more in the pipe from what they told me. So the critical thing to understand, I think, is that this transcoding problem or the conversion thing that YouTube is doing is a very specific kind of compute, to the point where the parameters are just well understood. They don't change. It's not like, you know, somebody using Microsoft, even something as simple as like Microsoft Word, like just all the different possibilities that somebody could do something in that one program, you know, requires a different, you know, lots of different kinds of computing to occur for your character to appear or whatever you would want. So the problem is specific to the point where they can create something. The Argos chip is what's called an application-specific integrated circuit. It's a lot of words, but you can think of it. It's the acronym is an ASIC, and these chips are just really, really good at doing one type of compute. The most common thing that I think everybody knows about is that these are used for Bitcoin mining, because they've designed chips that are just very good at making guesses to come up with the next, you know, Bitcoin or whatever. So in terms of performance, I mean, because this task is so specific, they could, you know, wire the chip in such a specific way. It allowed YouTube to gain 20 to 33x performance improvement with it. Is a perfect response, because that's a really big deal. I just told you Moore's Law was like doubling every 2 years, right? This is like, you know, an order of magnitude exponentially greater than that. So that for YouTube, that means a ton of savings in its data centers, because, you know, when you run a process in a data center, that's just money. You're just spending money. Mm-hmm. So they save money, and they have to build fewer data centers. It's the same sort of ideas around the TPU, the AI chip.
So before, they were using chips that were what, more standard, that would be used in all sorts of different applications. And so they thought, why don't we make a chip that is specifically, I mean, I know I didn't ask you about this beforehand, but I'm curious, How do you focus a chip? How do you make an ASIC in terms of what do you change in the makeup of a chip such that it focuses on something specifically? Is it just like, oh, we put all the transistors are on the left side like a half pepperoni pizza? What changes there?
I mean, I'm probably not the best person to ask about the physical wiring and layout of a chip. I just beyond my level of understanding. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is that, you know, again, it's everything is just geared around one function, so they can hard code, very specific stuff into it that maybe like and just designed to, like, for example, specifically encode a video with a specific encoding format. That's just one example. But like a regular CPU, like a regular chip that in your phone or whatever, mm-hmm. probably or might not have a specific like core or a specific function that's only designed to do this one very specific thing. It'll have stuff that can just do everything
That makes sense. So it's sort of like the difference between maybe, I don't know, I'm trying to think of how this will work, going to the beach and using a spaghetti spoon to put sand into a bucket versus getting a very specific beach trowel that you are supposed to use to make a sand castle. This is like one tool that you can do so many different things with. It'll do it, but not as great as having that very specific tool that you buy to make beach sandcastles.
Yeah, I think that's a decent way to put it. I would think about it. I do a lot of like home cooking. So this is the difference between using a chef's knife to cut or to devein a piece of shrimp versus a paring knife to devein a piece of shrimp. Right.
Perfect.
You can do it with both of them, but one of them is just way easier to do it with.
Yeah, that you better analogy. I should have relied on the chip guy for that analogy. Oh. Thank you. So let's talk about the next thing, because one of the points that caught my eye in your piece was the assertion that big tech companies aren't only considering the cost-saving benefits of designing their own chips. As you point out, kind of people think at first, oh, I know why they're making their own chips, because that's going to save them money. But it turns out that may not be the case in some instances, and that it's about something else. It's about a different goal. Can you talk about that? The other goals that they have in designing the chips?
Sure. I mean, you know, it is and it isn't about saving money, is how I would put it. They do save money, or sometimes they can save money. And in Google's case, they definitely are saving money. And what that allows them to do is take those resources and use them for something else, like anything else. So developing, I don't know, better buttons on YouTube, or I don't know, whatever the thing is.
However they do it.
Yeah, whatever the next thing they're trying to work on is. Or in YouTube's case, very specifically, what they're doing with the extra compute time that they have is they're taking videos that they might have not been able to convert to like better formats and convert those videos to better formats to give viewers a better experience. So that's the case for YouTube. I mean, yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to put it. It creates a competitive advantage for these companies. That's sort of the underlying principle, because if you think about somebody like AWS or Azure or any of the big cloud computing companies, they basically sell a commodity service, the compute time. Like, who cares like what kind of chip is powering the compute? Like, I care, right? But it's my job to care.
Right.
But most people, they just want to be able to get the most performance for the least amount of money. And for whatever it is that they're doing, whether it's AI or they're running database software or whatever. So if Amazon can say to somebody like, look, if you use our chips, you get this like extra performance and it'll cost you less money. And it's called their chips are called Gravitons. That to them is a way that they can sell more compute time. They can sell more of their cloud products to people. So on the, you know, that's one way to think about it. Also, like, I mean, the consumer example is so blindingly obvious. I mean, Apple now can say, well, look, our laptops are better because they're powered by something that's better because we designed it. And it's better than everything else because, you know, for X reason and Y, it's so fast and, you know, all that sort of other stuff. So that's on the consumer side, that's kind of what that equation looks like. It's a way of being able to differentiate. And there's truth to it, too. I have a MacBook I'm talking to on right now. It does. The battery life is better. I mean, for sure. Right. Yeah. So there's it's not like a totally nonsense claim, or it's not just like a marketing gimmick, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And then my last question for you. Because of these performance improvements and the sort of cost-saving benefits of not maybe having to build new data centers as often, one might say, okay, how come Google doesn't just do all of its own chip design? How come any company doesn't just do all of their own chip design? Why focus on these specific ones and not just kind of go all in-house? And I think it's a mostly obvious answer for sure, but it's still enough to go, well, yeah, why doesn't every company just go, you know what, let's just do all of our own chips?
Well, who says they're not going to?
That's true.
Partly the thing is, for Google, they were able to identify, again, some very specific areas where they're just spending the boatload of money, and that the compute problems were well understood. And the YouTube chip isn't like, I don't want to say it's like simple, but again, the design parameters are so clear that it was like obvious how to do it. They just had to do it. So for something like a general purpose processor, like, Google isn't in the silicon business. Like, it doesn't really want to be selling, I mean, I don't think it really wants to be selling chips to, you know, companies that produce laptops. I don't think that's what its sort of core mission is. I mean, they try to organize the world's information and do sorts of other things like that, which the AI stuff does actually help out quite a lot with. I mean, the thing that Google looks at it is they just looked across all of the different kinds of compute they were doing in the data center and then picked specific lanes that they knew that they could improve. Mm-hmm. I think you alluded to the obvious part around this and why Google doesn't just start making CPUs, like the laptop chips or graphics processors or what have you, is because NVIDIA and Intel and AMD are all very good at it. They spend billions of dollars, probably hundreds of billions of dollars combined, on their R&D efforts. They have product roadmaps that extend 5 or so years. Everybody knows what's coming. And it's just to even enter that business. Okay, just by way of example, to design a one of the most advanced chips, just to design it. I'm not talking about making a single one of them or just to design it, to get it to the point where you can print one chip easily. $500 million.
So
that's one chip, right? So if to make a desktop processor, you need to make like a bunch of them because there's different kinds of laptops. There's expensive laptops and less expensive laptops. Same is true for the data center. Intel has dozens of data center chips that you can buy. So to design all of those things is just, it's an incredibly expensive, you know, proposition. And that's not to even discuss the actual talent needs that are associated with it. You have to have like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of engineers in order to be able to design a leading edge chip. Just another, by way of another example, MediaTek, which is a Taiwanese, they make smartphone chips. They design them, I should say. They put 5,000 engineers on a single 5G modem chip. Like, that's the kind of, and that's not, I mean, that's a hard chip to make, but it's not even an advanced GPU that like makes video games look great.
Right.
So I suspect that's probably the reason, is that it just, there's no economic incentive and the big chip companies are also pretty good at it. I would say, I just wanted to just finish up with the fact that even for Google's or even for YouTube's Argos chips, one of the executives I spoke with said he would be happy to buy them off the shelf. He just can't.
They weren't there. Yeah,
they weren't there. So they're four generations in. He said basically if generation five, if Intel makes a generation five chip that he could just buy off the shelf, they would absolutely just do it. Right. So it's more of like an out of necessity thing for Google versus we really kind of want to get into the chip business. But it's also worth thinking about, every chip that any of these companies make is a dollar that one of the other chip makers does not get.
Absolutely.
So it's going to be interesting to see in the longer run how the chip makers respond to this like very clear trend. Maybe they'll be consulting businesses. Maybe they'll, I don't know. But it's just something to like big picture wise to think about. So
yeah, you'd almost have to have like a task team where the company calls you and it's like, oh yeah, we've got 1,000 engineers that are ready to tackle this problem for you. Please use us instead of doing it internally. That makes sense.
And that did happen a bit when Google was developing its TPUs. I think they worked with Broadcom to help design it. So it's not like that doesn't happen already.
Mm-hmm. Well, Max Cherney, thank you so much for stopping by again to talk to us about the YouTube chip this time. Of course, folks can head over to Protocol to check out your work. But if they want to follow you online, where should they go to do so?
Best place to do it is probably on Twitter. I'm at Churn and Burn, CHERNANDBURN. You can also find me on LinkedIn. I post stuff there, too, from time to time. So either of those places is a good spot.
Awesome. Well, thank you again.
thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you, Max. Up next, we've got my stories of the week. But first, we're going to take another quick break so I can tell you about ZipRecruiter, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. Certain people, you probably think of certain people out there who just make your life a lot easier. I certainly have a few. And you just don't know what you do without them. It could be your partner, your friend, your personal assistant. It's like if you need to grow your business, ZipRecruiter is that person that's there for you. ZipRecruiter makes hiring so much easier because they do that work for you. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. ZipRecruiter's technology finds the right candidates for your job, and you can invite your top choices to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So it's no surprise that ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site based on G2 ratings as of January 1st of this year, 2022. And I know here at Twit that ZipRecruiter has come through a number of times for our hires. And it's always there to make sure that we get those qualified candidates and that they are available rather quickly. It's great. The hardest thing you have to do is to remember the special URL we have to try ZipRecruiter for free. It's ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. Thank you so much to ZipRecruiter for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, first up on my stories of the week list is a story for all of you out there who use Plex. So I, like many of you, am a Plex user. Plex has been a sponsor on the network in the past. And Plex is a media streaming storage management solution. It does a lot. Plex is a really powerful service that lets you maintain a library of media, be it music, movies, TV shows, all sorts of stuff. And they've got different bits of the service that let you create like a personal server on your home network. Many people will use a network attached storage to store their movies and their whole library and then stream it to their television or use the Plex app on their phone or visit Plex on the website and like in the browser and be able to stream from their own library. I've been on a number of podcasts in the past where they're, you know, we're talking about a specific show. They're media related podcasts, and perhaps you don't have the movie in your own library. That's where Plex has come through, where someone can say, "Hey, I've got this movie. Here's what you need to be able to watch it." So Plex is very, very handy. And as I said, I know many of us have it. So you may have gotten an email, but if you didn't, check your email to hear about how Plex is telling you you need to reset your passwords. Plex sent out an email to users saying, "Hey, look, we were looking through our databases and discovered some suspicious activity. And obviously, this meant that after we discovered this activity, we needed to investigate and came to realize that a third party, as they call it, was able to access, quote, a limited subset of data that includes emails, usernames, and encrypted passwords." Now, these passwords were hashed. These passwords, you know, were protected in that way. But out of an abundance of caution, Plex is making everyone reset their passwords. This is a very sort of low-level threat for folks who use password managers. Like, if you asked me my Plex password right now, I couldn't tell you because I don't know it. My password manager knows it. And so that means that if somehow the bad actor who got into Plex was somehow able to beat the encryption of the passwords, which is very highly unlikely, and therefore get those passwords, it wouldn't mean anything because the only thing they would have access to is the thing they already had access to, which is Plex's account. So absolutely make sure that you're using a password manager. And absolutely make sure that you're using two-factor authentication, because those two things together make for a very secure account that, despite a bad actor getting into Plex, they don't have access to everything else. That's often the question of, like, why? Why do I need to use a password manager? Why do I need to have different passwords for everything? I make my passwords just a little bit different for everything, so that should be fine, right? Oftentimes what I've found when people say that is, at some point, someone came along to them and said, you shouldn't be using the same password for everything. You need to change your password. And the person goes, okay. And so they start to make a slightly different password for all the new accounts that they create. But that password they'd been using the whole time is still on the accounts they already have. And oftentimes the accounts they already have are their most important accounts. These are the accounts that matter the most. And so despite doing that little bit of a change up, they're still using an insecure password because you are only as protected as the weakest account in your library of accounts that you access. So while your bank may have protections and your email may have protections, if you went to radishseeds.com and created an account there and used the same password that you do with your bank account and your, your Gmail account, then when the hacker comes along to radishseeds.com, don't go there, I don't know what's there, and sees that those passwords aren't hashed, aren't protected, aren't encrypted, and all they have to do is pull from the WordPress document that's stored online on radishseeds.com and get the, you know, hundreds of passwords and accounts, then they can take that password from that place and that email from that place and put them together and go to your very strongly protected Gmail or your very strongly protected bank, type it in, and they're just able to get inside. That is why we say use a password manager and use two-factor authentication, because then if radishseeds.com gets hacked, they've only got access to that one site where I created a password that's QRP297134:!! And they don't have access to anything else. So when I got this email, I wasn't too worried about it because they, again, just got my username, which I do use across different sites, and my email, which I do use across different sites. But I've slowly also started to break out of that habit as well. That's how you level up, is when you start to include pseudo-random emails as part of your logins, or pseudo-random usernames as part of your logins, and just let your password manager handle all of it. The password manager that I use, 1Password, actually has an integration with Fastmail, which is the email program that I use, that when I create a new login, will automatically generate a new email via Fastmail, pseudo-random, you know, that's tied to that, to my email. And so it just forwards it along to my actual email address. So then the username is unique, the password is unique, and I know that if they get access to that, they're not getting access to everything else, because you may have in the past gotten emails, I certainly have, where they've emailed me at my my iCloud account, for example, because they got it in some password breach at some point. And maybe they even were able to go as far as to get my actual password that I used to use for different sites, monkey123. And they sent me an email that said, hey, we know your password, monkey123, and they put it in bold. And then they said, we used it to log into your account and found a bunch of, inappropriate content, was the claim. And we will share this with the world, basically, unless you send us Bitcoin. And I will be honest that seeing that password in there, even though the whole outer part of my mind and my body and everything were going, from the get-go knew that this was just a spam email, that it was a phishing attempt. Still seeing that password did make my heart go boom, boom a little bit. Wait, they got my password. So I can't imagine the number of folks who don't have as much knowledge about this particular topic as I do, looking at that and going, holy moly. And then they know that a subset of those people will also somewhere on some service or some system have some inappropriate content. And so then they will be moved to action. They try to get you with that fear. So while these things on the face of them may seem not innocuous, obviously in any case it's bad, but while it may seem like it's not such a big deal, it actually is quite a big deal. And we should do what we can to protect ourselves. So if you, like I, got this Plex email, hey, even if you didn't get this Plex email, if you have a Plex account, go to Plex. I just went to Plex.com. I logged in with my Plex account, and then I went in and went to the change your password area and did that, changed my password. And what's cool is Plex has a great little checkbox you can check that says log out of all logged in accounts. So you can do both at the same time, kick it to the curb, anything that, you know, may have access somehow. Again, that's highly unlikely through this breach, but it's just well worth doing. And now I've got a new Plex password, which is kind of fun. I don't know. It kind of feels like if I was a snake and I had, it was time to shed my skin and start with a fresh outer coating. That's what it feels like every time I change a password. It's like, we are removing the past. We're sloughing away the dead and we're starting anew. It's nice to create a new password from time to time. So, yeah, head there. Get that password change, make it happen. The other story that I wanted to briefly mention, this is just a fun feel-good story. Many of you who watch or listen to the shows that I do know that I have two dogs and that I love dogs and think that dogs are an absolute gift to humanity. And there are a number of scientific studies that we have long known because of these studies. Rather, there are a number of facts that we know about dogs due to scientific studies that have been going on for quite some time. And I wanted to start with one that has been around for a while about how dogs kind of hijack, not knowingly, but unknowingly, kind of hijack the hormonal response, the inbuilt hormonal response that humans have in regard to our children. So a unique thing about dogs, by dogs, I mean domesticated dogs that are not wolves, is that they are, they will often look you in your eyes. A dog will make eye contact with you. And you will then, if it's your pet, make eye contact with it. Wolves do not do this because when wolves make eye contact, they take it as they are actually expressing aggression. And if they see you making eye contact with them, they think you are expressing aggression. So it is odd that dogs do this in the first place, given their heritage. But dogs do make eye contact. And so there was a study where they had several people with their dogs come in and sit down with their dogs and talk to them. And they had part of the group that was told to, when the dog looked at them and made eye contact, to look at the dog and kind of talk to them while you're looking at them. And then the other group was told to kind of not avoid eye contact per se, but make less eye contact. And so they monitored the two groups to make sure that they were holding to the instructions of the study. And afterward, they did a urine test for both the humans and the canines. And in the dogs, both male and female dogs who made eye contact with their owners experienced a 130% rise in oxytocin levels, and the human beings, male and female, saw a 300% increase in oxytocin levels. Scientists saw no oxytocin increase in the dogs and the owners who had spent little time gazing at each other. And they also brought in some folks who actually had wolves, or the closest thing that you can get to wolves and it still be legal. And they did not have any increase in oxytocin. What we know about oxytocin, or what we think we know about oxytocin, is that it is a, we call it the trust hormone. It increases trust and goodwill between people, and it is one of the hormones that when a parent looks at their infant in particular, there's a rise in oxytocin. So dogs, for some reason, will look us in our eyes, and it's not seen as an aggression, is instead this sort of learned behavior, we think, to where they don't realize that what they're doing is oxytocin increase, but it improves the increases the oxytocin in their brain and in yours. And the other thing that dogs do that we've known for quite some time is they are uniquely aware of a human's emotional state and can sort of, it's almost like reading the room when it comes to humans. I'm not talking to you. My Google device went off, but they can kind of uniquely read a human being whenever they look at them. And so when you point, if you've got a dog, you may have done this before and not even knowing this, but you drop something on the floor that they are okay to eat and you point at it and then they look and they go and they get it. Chimpanzees, our closest relatives, don't even understand pointing. If you point at something near a chimpanzee, they don't understand that gestural motion that you're making is saying, hey, I want you to look at that over there. But somehow dogs understand that. Very cool. And so that leads us to the most recent study that I wanted to talk about real quick now. I know we're running out of time. And that is that a new study shows that dogs cry tears of joy when they're reunited with their owners. So dogs who've been separated from their owners for a longer period of time actually see an increase in tear production around the return of their owner and a huge jump in oxytocin levels when they are reconnected with their owners. And this is what it says. In humans, tear volume increases during emotional arousal. We performed the tear test and measured tear volume in dogs before and after reunions with owners and familiar non-owners. Tear volume increased significantly during reunion with the owner, but not with a familiar non-owner. So let me be clear there. The dog had an emotional response to its owner that it didn't even have with someone that it was familiar with, but that was its non-owner. So it would be like, you know, Henry, my dog, seeing me after a period of time versus, well, there's not a lot of people that he knows here, but the point is, the difference is enough that the dog can have that response. So anyway, we'll include a link in the show notes, as we always do, to this study. And it's well worth reading if you're a dog person, especially just to learn about kind of how they administered this test and just more that proves to me and to everyone that dogs are humanity's best friend. Love them. And I thank you all for tuning in to this episode of Tech News Weekly and hanging out with me today as I recorded this show. We publish the show every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go to subscribe to the show in audio and video formats. And also, if you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, well, there's a way to do that. It's called Club Twit. twit.tv/clubtwit. For $7 a month, you get every single Twitch show with no ads. Yes, ad free all the way around. You get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, outtakes, all sorts of stuff there. And access to the members only Discord server. That's a place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. It's a fun place to be, to share your interests, send lots of fun animated photos, and perhaps talk about dogs. So check that out, twit.tv/clubtwit, $7 a month. Oh, and I should also mention that you'll get the Hands on Mac show that publishes every Thursday. That's my show where I talk about all sorts of Apple device tips and tricks. Today, I will be talking about a great app for the Mac called Trip Mode and how it helps to save your online activity from using too much and can improve your video calls in that way. And there's also Hands on Windows from Paul Thurrott, which is a show all about tips and tricks for Windows. Twit.tv/clubtwit, $7 a month. Please do check that out. Or $84 a year if you just want to get the whole year out of the way. If you'd like to tweet at me or follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, that's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Thank you to those of you in the studio helping make this show possible. John Ashley, who pretty much does everything behind the scenes. Very appreciative to you for making this show a reality. And Burke for also helping to make sure our guests sound and look good and that the show goes off without a hitch. We appreciate you, and I appreciate all of you out there who are tuning in to watch the show today or listening to it later. Thank you so much for your time, and Jason and I will see you next week. Goodbye.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow is a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.